This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA podcast.
Really quickly, before we get into this episode, I wanted to mention my Patreon. Patrons get all of the podcasts a week early. I do giveaways, I do some other stuff, but most importantly, if you want me to review your music or artwork or anything else, Patreon is the way to do that. Every month, I do a call for submissions. All you need to do if you want me to review something is just post it in the comments of that post. Then I will review it live on Twitch for the hundreds of people that tune into every stream and post it on Patreon for everyone to check out. All you need to do is just join at the $10 and up level. Stay tuned for that post and you are good to go. So if that sounds cool to you and you want me to review your music, artwork, or anything else, hit the link in the show notes for this episode. And thank you very much to everyone who supports over on Patreon. Misha, welcome to the show. Thank you for making time for this. I know you have a lot of stuff going on.
Thanks for having me. I will always, always make time for you, Finn.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet of you. Well, let's start off with something spicy so people keep listening. How many cars do you have right now?
I have four cars right now.
Honda Civic, Honda Prelude.
Hey, don't diss the Civic. I was trying to buy a Civic for a while, but they were very overpriced. I love the Civic.
The 90, like the early 90s Civic, right?
No, the Civic Type R, okay. The FK8 and the FL5 are both. I haven't driven the FL5 yet, but we should be getting a press car soon. Yeah, the FK8 is one of the best cars. It's just one of the best.
My dream is to get a 1990 Integra and restore it to factory condition, complete with AM/FM cassette stereo.
I have bad news for you. Everybody wants to do that, so the prices are out of control. Like Integra is like, especially any like Integra Type R's or anything clean. If you ever follow Bring a Trailer, like you're gonna see. I think like there was like an old Civic Si or something. Like there's some cars you're just like, wait, they're commanding how much? And they're just kind of regular cars from our childhood, but they're just right. Examples.
Damn it. Well, every other old guy has the same dream as me. So
we all have the same dream. That's the problem. We're all individuals.
All right. Well, I guess I got to find something else. Well, tell me where you're at with this album. I know last I heard it was pretty close to done. Where is that at right now?
It is mastered and turned in, and I should be getting some of the vinyl test presses on Tuesday.
Oh, nice.
We're there. We've got artwork done. We're just getting all the planning together, you know, so that we can get the release to be right. You obviously know how much work goes into that.
Yeah.
You also probably know how frustrating it is to have something be done and not know that it can't be out for, you know, many months.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that little limbo right now.
Yeah, it's just kind of how it is. Especially, my understanding is the vinyl situation has been especially backed up.
Oh, man, it's bad. I have to appreciate, like, everyone's patience. Because not only has it been bad, but, you know, for those who don't know, so when you do vinyl, they send you test presses, which I think for the longest time, I always felt was a bit of a formality until we started to get test presses that had problems. You know, like they'll have, like, a lot of noise or some clicks or they'll skip and that you get several. So if all your test presses are like skipping in the same place, you're like, all right, well, that's something wrong with the cut itself. Right. And I don't know exactly what's going on, but ever since we've had this supply shortage we've also been having a lot more problematic test presses. So now the test presses are more important than ever, because in the past I could have been like, oh, it's probably fine. Now you're getting these problematic ones and you got to resolve that and wait even longer. And you're sort of planning everything, as you know, well in advance. And then the lead times, as we've sort of learned the hard way, you'll get people that will tell you, oh, it's, you know, 5 or 6 months, which sounds like a lot, but then other people are like, yeah, it'll be a year. And so you're like, oh, well, I'll go with the guy who says it'll be 5 or 6 months, and then they take a year.
Right.
So the answer is it takes a year. And, you know, I have some friends that are even looking at opening up their own plants just because the demand is so crazy right now. It's probably a pretty smart investment if it's something that you're passionate about.
And that would be agonizing to wait for a goddamn year.
Well, here's the other thing is that, like, again, you know this very well, but like when you want to put out an album, ideally you want everything to come out at the same time. I don't think it'll actually be a year. I think the lead times are a bit more reasonable now, but we have to get everything in so early so that we can hope to have the vinyl in and hopefully out like within a week, you know, of release date or something like that. Because otherwise what will happen if you sort of do the traditional method is that people will pre-order the vinyl to get the packages and whatever, but it won't come out for 3-4 months after that. And that, if you don't have sort of very clear language surrounding that, could be really upsetting.
Yeah, even if you do, you can't expect everyone to read the fine print on that stuff.
And, right.
You know,
and they'll be like, wait, so I don't have my vinyl for another 3 months, you know, and that right. kind of sucks. And I'm a vinyl collector myself. So I'm on both sides of this equation. And I'd say that as a consumer, I've become a lot more patient. Like there's stuff I've like pre-ordered where it's just like, we don't know when this is going to arrive. And I'm like, okay, well, at least I'll get one. You know, it's always like one of like 500 or 1,000. It's like, all right, I'm guaranteed to get it at some point. And there's some I'm still waiting on where, you know, who knows when it'll arrive, but hopefully it will arrive. So there is sort of that understanding. It's a bit of this FOMO play, but it does make it very, very difficult to sort of strategize for launches and things like that.
And is this coming out on your label, 3Dot?
Yep, this nice. Will be a 3Dot release. That's what would make the most sense. It's kind of why we started the label, actually, was to have a vehicle to put our you know, periphery and our side projects out. And it sort of expanded from there, just mainly from curiosity to see what we can kind of do, you know? But yeah, obviously, we'll be leading the charge with our own albums.
You hear a lot of people say that you don't need a label anymore and you can do everything independent and blah, 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 which is all true on paper, as long as you are willing and able to do all the work, which I would say most artists either can't or don't want to do all the stuff that you're talking about.
Right. That's very well put. It's like they start the sentence, but they don't finish it. So the sentiment is correct. Yeah. Not you don't need a label. You also don't need a manager. You also sure. you don't need the tour. You don't need to do anything. It's what is the trade-off? And, you know, if your time is worth zero and you have an abundance of it and you can, you know, deal with the stress and you don't have like a full-time job and you don't mind putting in the work and doing that stuff. And you sort of have the experience or expertise to know what you're doing so that you're not wasting the time that you do have. Sure. You could do it without a label and you'll see some people work very effectively without a label. But for a lot, or I would say even most bands, there's a lot that a label could bring to the table that they won't even realize is being done. And generally, like, it may be even a little bit of a thankless job because there's so much stuff happening on the back end that the artists would never even have to interact with. That it almost feels like nothing's happening, you know, but these are just, again, as you know, all sides of this, and anyone who does know all sides of this knows like how much of the little minutiae is involved and how much work is involved with actually releasing an album and all the stuff that goes wrong. Basically anything that you don't directly control always goes wrong.
Right. If you don't follow up on it, it's guaranteed it's not going to go okay.
Exactly. So it's not, again, label, it's not a necessity. It's not for everyone, but even for people where you could get away without the label, the question is, do you want that? Do you want to trade, or would you rather, you know, one thing that we've tried to do is do these very artist centric deals. So where they're getting their fair share, sometimes depending on the artist and the deal, sometimes the majority doing licensing deals, doing things, deals that like we were never offered. Just understanding like that's kind of what's fair, in my opinion, and maybe being a little bit of the spoke in the wheels of the industry and changing the expectation with that as your deal. Yeah, maybe you won't get quite as much of an advance, but as you know, it's a loan. But then ultimately, you might be making very similar amounts of money, you know, from the extra promotion, whatever, right, and not having nearly as much work. So it might actually even be a win-win with the right deal. And people always ask me, they're like, oh, well, should I sign to this label or that label or this label? And this is even before we did our label, but it was like, well, you shouldn't sign to any label, sign the deal.
Right, exactly. Depends on the label and who at the label has your back and wants to fight for you.
Right. And all of that will be reflected in the deal and in the negotiations, and you'll get a good sense of that. So you can't ever just say, because people will be like, you know, is Sumerian a good label? It's like, well, they are if you get a good record deal, you know?
Right.
Like, they're at least honest enough to where they will exercise their record deal, like largely to what's written on paper. So you wouldn't have to worry about that. So in that sense, they're good, sure. But they also offered some of the absolute worst record deals I've ever seen to some bands. I'm like, don't ever sign that.
Nobody put a gun to their head and made them sign it.
No, of course not. And that's kind of the interesting position. This is what I would love to sort of play counter to a little bit, is the idea that you could offer a band that doesn't fully understand the dynamics of what's going on and how all this works, a record deal, with them thinking that this is some sort of massive step, we made it. And then you could sort of leverage that to give them the worst deal ever, because they're like, well, at least it's a deal, as if that is somehow a good sentiment, right?
Right.
And then if they're smart enough to say no to that, there's 100 other bands that would say yes. So you're in this very advantageous position to sort of, you know, opportunistically take advantage of bands that don't know any better. And that's why I don't sort of mind being, as I said, like a bit of a spoke in the wheels to that side of the industry, where we can offer like very aggressive deals to labels, but we're also very picky about who we work. Like, we're not really accepting submissions. It's more like bands we're stoked on or bands we believe in, or that we're like, oh, that it would be really cool to be part of this and to help that out and kind of be the label that I wish that we had when we were starting, you know?
Right. One of the things that I appreciate so much about Periphery, you know, aside from the music, is that you guys have always defied so many expectations. I mean, going back to like, you know, doing the licensing deals that you did and stuff. But in particular, one of the things that I have always admired is that you guys didn't ever really do a whole lot of touring.
Yeah, I think we did in the beginning, and then kind of, well, okay, so there's this band, Meshuggah, and our entire existence is just ripping them off.
I disagree with that, which we can talk about later. People say that all the time. I do not think that's true, because if you listen to Periphery next to Meshuggah, they don't sound the same aside from some of the riffs.
Well, it does to me.
Only if you're a guitarist and you ignore the vocals.
Sure, sure. Well, what I was just going to say is like another thing we ripped them off with was their touring strategy, because it was interesting. I kind of learned this lesson the hard way. So obviously they're my favorite band, and they're like one of my favorite bands, if not my favorite band to see live. And one time they came to town, I didn't have anyone to go with, and I did the usual like, I'll catch them next time. They didn't come back for 3 years. And that's where I learned, don't make that mistake. And meanwhile, I would see like a lot of our peers going out doing like 3 headliners a year, 3 US headliners.
Playing Sacramento 3 times a year.
Right. And then what it does is it creates this culture within your fan base of, yeah, I'll just go see them next time. And then you could see like guarantees stagnating or sometimes
right,
getting worse, and like the offers getting worse. And it's sort of counterintuitive, because you'd be saying, oh, we're getting out there more. Surely our guarantees should be going up. But I do think there's a bit of a curve to it.
It's supply and demand.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. People forget the business side of it. So there has to be a little bit of strategy. So what we started to do was just get a little bit strategic with our touring. You know, we changed management. I think now we've just been with our manager, Wayne. We've been with him longer than we haven't been.
5 years or something now, maybe?
No. No, way more. Because the pandemic,
really?
Is like 3 of those years. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Wow. No. That's exactly what I'm saying. I think it's like closer to like 8 or 9 years now.
Okay.
I don't want to think about it. I'm old.
Yeah.
I'm actually very young. I'm 22. But yeah, the one of the things that I kind of, when we were looking at new managers and wanted to see sort of what their plan was, one of the things that we did, because we didn't tell the managers what we wanted. We let them come to us and be like, okay, what, and we'd ask, what's your vision? And that's one of the things that our manager Wayne was very much on board with, was that he was like, I think that like you could go out and just do the usual touring thing, or we could get a bit more creative with it and we could get a bit more strategic, you know? And I think Wayne, and working with our booking agent, Nick Storch, who's also a very sort of creative guy, and not all booking agents are equal. Like, so Nick is very much into like just trying to see like what other things we could do. And I feel like he has a good grasp of the bands that he works with, because there isn't this one size fits all solution. So he's always coming at us being like, okay, given that it's your band, what could work well is if we try this or that.
Because you would think, you know, managers and booking agents get, for those who don't know, get paid a percentage of what the band makes.
Yes.
And so generally speaking, the default thing would be that the manager and booking agent want you out there on the road working as much as possible so that everyone makes the most money. Yep. And not everybody would be on board with the strategy you're talking about.
No, it's probably at least part of the reason that general touring strategy, if you want to call it, is what we see, where it's just this oversaturation.
Right.
Kind of doesn't matter if the band's guarantees are going down, because you're still getting, you know, your 15% of like 10% less than the last tour, but 10% less than the last tour is still better than zero. So if that is your goal, and it's very tough to find a very good manager, and it's very tough to find a good booking, it's tough to find good people in general, I'd say. That's why when we were looking at it, it was sort of an important thing. And that's why we didn't tell the managers we were talking to what we were looking for, because then we wouldn't be able to sort of guide their answers.
You don't want them to just say, yeah, sounds good, just to sign you. But I'll talk them out of it later.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we have that strategy, and why we've been touring less, is trying to create a bit of scarcity and trying to create a culture of scarcity, so that when we do go out, because as you know, it's so competitive and there's so many great bands. And ever since streaming became a thing, all the bands are always on tour all the time. You know, the package that you put together for tour is incredibly important, and the markets that you're playing become very strategic, because great, you want to play this market, you got a good offer, but are there three other shows that night that you're competing with, and that will make you look bad, because now you're not drawing, even though on the last tour you did really well, but now your data points are down because of an element that when people are looking at your data, well, they won't be aware of that. They'll just be like, that's interesting. So you actually did worse the last time you played New York, you know, and that's bad. So all, like I say, I do not envy the job of a booking agent or a manager.
You guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys don't even really do a lot of the big festivals, do you?
No, but I'd say that's been sort of weird, sort of chance, and just the way things have worked out. It's not because we have anything against them. I quite like doing them, and we've played around with them and played with a few different things, but it just has always fallen through. And actually, we were supposed to do Download, but then the pandemic happened.
Right.
We're not anti-festival. I'd like to do more festivals, but it's just, there's always something. And even that Download offer just kept getting pushed back because it was never quite right. And then that was the year where it was like, all right, everything's lining up. It's perfect. Let's finally do it. And then the pandemic happened. So, you know, we're definitely open to festivals, but as with all things in this industry, the offer has to be right. It has to make sense.
Well, one thing about Periphery is that you guys are very picky about what you say yes to. And I mean that in a good way. And you guys negotiate hard on everything, because I think you know your value and you're going to expect to get it. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of the reason why you're able to be that way is because you have leverage, because you have so many other things going on, you know, like all your other companies and the various different things the band does. So you're not desperate to just, you don't have your backs against the wall to just say yes to this offer.
Yeah, that's a very astute point. So again, it was kind of learning from other bands, and like what we'd seen was like bands that, again, maybe were going out on a headliner, because obviously you cash out on a headliner. I always consider like support tours like investing in, and then your headliner is your cash out. So you cash out on a headliner because you got bills to pay, which is kind of the most unfortunate situation to be in, because now strategy's out the window. It's just kind of a desperation play, you know? And you know, every band will do that at some point, and it's fine, but you really want to minimize those, because it's sort of working against the band, you know? And it's, if you have any strategy for your scarcity, really, really messes that whole plan of action up. So very early on, like, you know, we all had discussion being like, all right, this band is not going to make us money. So go figure other shit out, you know, like whatever it is. And we've all kind of done that to different degrees over the years. And then there's a level of freedom that comes from that, because, you know, I had a conversation with my dad and he was like, so you never became a musician, did you? And I was like, yeah, I guess not. He's like, no, you became a businessman. So it's like, I've actually failed at becoming a professional musician. I'm just a hobbyist. But I think it's also, when I started Periphery, you know, I had a full-time job and I loved doing music in my free time. And it was very much just like, just a pure form of self-expression.
What were you doing for work back then?
When I first started, I was working at Radio Shack. I was doing sales.
Okay. This is like 2009-ish or so?
No, that would be like 2005 or six. Yeah.
I thought Bulb turned into Periphery. Is that not right?
It was always this kind of like fast and loose thing. Like the idea was Bulb was my solo stuff and Periphery was whatever the band was going to be.
Oh, okay. But you've used some Bulb stuff for Periphery, right?
Totally. Okay. Yeah. It's like it was like Periphery was what I was investing in. So if there was ever an idea that wanted to get used, all the Bulb stuff, and that's still the case. It's not necessarily called Bulb, but like, you know, I still do write a lot of stuff or demos or whatever. Anything the band wants, the band can take, you know? And there've been cases of like things that I thought I was going to save for like my solo album, for example, but the band wanted it. It's like, all right, cool. You know, we'll use it for that instead or Haunted Shores or whatever. The sort of real projects will always take precedence over like Bulb or any solo stuff, because I could just write more, you know?
Right. So when did music become your full-time job then?
I would say it was probably around like 2009, yeah, and like 2010, around then when Periphery started to tour, and I couldn't really like hold down a full-time job and tour. And one thing that happened was I accidentally became a producer by doing the Animals as Leaders album, you know, which really was just a way to get Tosin to not quit music, because that whole situation was so frustrating to him that he was threatening to like quit music, I think move to Sweden and become a teacher or something with his girlfriend at the time. And I was like, that sounds great and all, but I don't really believe in God or anything, but I think you were put on earth to like play guitar, dude. Like,
yeah, that would be kind of a loss for humanity.
And he would be a great philosophy teacher. I mean, sure. Like we definitely talk a lot about that stuff and chat about that. He's very, very intelligent and well-read with that kind of stuff. So I think he would do well. But not to the degree that he is like this like force of nature as a musician and a guitarist. So that is definitely the correct path. And that's why I was working at the Container Store at that time. And I was like, just pay me enough money to where I could take a month off work and we'll do this album so that you don't have to quit music.
I am a fan of the Container Store, though.
Yeah, you got that alpha shelving in there?
Yeah, it's relaxing. I enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was a solid job. I preferred working at Radio Shack because it was commission.
Oh.
And that's where I learned how to sell.
I see. That makes sense.
That's where you learn the beauty of like, well, if you sell efficiently, you don't have to work as many hours. Mm-hmm. I was working like 4 6-hour days a week. And making more, and I remember trying to get a job at Guitar Center, but they didn't want me. So my friends who did get
that's hilarious in hindsight.
It is kind of funny in hindsight, but it was better because I could walk to work to Radio Shack. So I didn't have a car. My overhead was pretty low. And yeah, and like I just would work 4 days a week, about 6-hour shifts. And that's all I really needed to make ends meet. And then the rest of the time was just for music. So it worked out pretty well.
But you did, like when you were, you know, a teenager or whatever, your goal was to do music full time?
In the way that any like teenager like dreams of things. You know, it was like
okay.
A dream. I didn't start playing guitar till I was like about 13 or 14. Like I started on drums. And yeah, like that's when I sort of discovered music in a way where I thought this would be really sick if that was my job. But again, the dream of it and the reality of it couldn't be more different. So I didn't really know what I was getting into. And I think, you know, I say this now maybe only semi-seriously, but I think if I knew everything that went into it and how much luck goes into it and how much just being in the right place at the right time, I don't think I would have tried doing music, because it's insane that it worked at all, you know?
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like, I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode. And also, I want to thank Rockabilia for sponsoring this episode. If you're into merch, and if you're listening to this, then I know you probably are, then you definitely need to check out Rockabilia, because they have more band merch than anybody else on the planet. Over 500,000 items. Rockabilia has everything from the usual stuff like hoodies, t-shirts, and tank tops to other stuff, accessories like belts, watches, footwear, all kinds of stuff for both men and women, which is pretty cool because my wife is always complaining about how hard it is to find good merch. They even have a children's section and they have a home decor section. So if you want to get an Opeth pint glass or a Dark Throne skateboard, they have got you covered. Rockabilia also has a lot of really cool posters and flags, which as a fan of visual arts is something that I really appreciate, and some unique items like backstage passes and tab books. I mean, you could spend all day looking through this stuff, and I would have killed to have something like this when I was a kid, so I am glad that this exists. So if you want to check out Rockabilia and get some new merch, all you need to do is go to rockabilia.com or hit the link in the show notes of this episode, and make sure to use the discount code PRMBA, that is like Punk Rock MBA, to get 15% off your order. And thanks again to Rockabilia for sponsoring this episode.
Well, I think you did kind of maybe inadvertently sort of lay the template for basically how, I don't know, like, especially in metal, so many independent musicians do things now as far as being a one-man band, you know, going back to like the Bold days or whatever, building your community like you did on, you know, the forums and stuff like that, producing everything yourself, really being just this self-contained thing and, you know, using the tools that were available to you at the time, even though back then they were a lot shittier than they are now and the you know, the whatever old people would tell you that you can't use amp sims and all that stuff that they said back then, you really did kind of, I mean, there were other, you know, Meshuggah, again, obviously did a lot of those same things as well. But I think maybe more than anyone else in metal that I can think of, you really did kind of blaze that trail.
There was a bunch of us. There was a group of us, like, and in that group was like John Brown from Monument,
yep.
Ackle from Tesseract,
yep.
Chimp Spanner, who's been like starting to re-release music again. And it makes me really happy because he.
Oh,
like,
nice.
We all kind of secretly agreed that he was the best at it, you know, and he's insane. But yeah, it was us just kind of finding this tool and being like, that's interesting, wonder what we could do with this, you know, and just right. kind of in real time finding out. And those guys kept me on my toes, man, because they're all so talented, and I just felt like I was clearly the worst out of the group that you know, I'd hear the demos, I'd hear the production quality, like, and how well the drums were programmed and how cool the guitar tone was. And I'd listen to what I was doing. I'm like, oh my God. Like,
I was listening to the Fell Silent demo from 2005. It sounds fucking insane. It sounds so modern.
I listened to that album, or I was like kind of perusing through it recently, and I was like, man, this holds up.
It absolutely does.
And that was a big album. And like, you know, that was like, that's why, like, I think, like, to some degree, like, Brown and Ackle were always like a step above for me, because they're like, they're in a real band. Like,
right.
The rest of us are just fakers. We just post on forums.
Right.
These guys like playing shows. Like, I was seeing videos of them playing shows. I'm like, God damn, they sounded great live. Like, they were perfect. Yep. And I was like, all right, well, you know, it just made me feel like very small, and like, man, I had to really work to try to do anything that was worthwhile. And I always felt like I was coming short, you know? So, but it was good. It kept me on my toes and it kept me working hard, you know, kept me honest.
If anything, what would you do differently now? Like, you know, if you could go back to, you know, your 2005 self or whatever, would you do anything differently?
I don't think so. I'm sure there's like more efficient ways to do things, but I'm pretty stubborn, and like, sometimes the best way to learn is the hard way, you know? I also, on a philosophical level, as long as you're generally happy, it's very hard to regret your past, because it all kind of
gets
you to where you are. There's many examples of, in a vacuum, regrets I have or things I wish I could do differently. But then if I were to logically play out how those things, because sometimes they're usually the things you regret is because it's like what feels like a pivotal moment. But then if you were to actually logically play that out from there, it would actually send you off on a completely different path to where you may be somewhere unrecognizable. Now, maybe it's better, maybe it's worse, but it's entirely unknown. So I can't have much confidence in that.
And that's how I think about it. It's like, man, there's so many fucking stupid things I did 15 or 20 years ago, but I love my life now. So I guess I wouldn't do it any differently.
I forget who said this. Maybe it was Mark Manson. But he was like, if you don't cringe at your past, then that means you haven't been growing, you know, which sounds like kind of a trite thing to say. But when you think about it, it's actually very accurate. It's like, because you do cringe at stuff that you did in the past. You're like, God, I was such an idiot. It's like, no, I think that because I've improved and I wouldn't do that anymore. So it's actually like proof of growth. So, yeah, there's a lot of dumb stuff that I did. But again, I find it very hard to regret any of that stuff, because it's obviously part of the building blocks of what led me to here. And I'm generally pretty happy right now. So, you know, I'm not like miserable to where I wish my life was completely different. So, you know, I can't really regret it.
Was there ever a time where you considered doing something else as like a serious career? Cause I mean, knowing your family and stuff, I know you know, you could have gone in any number of different directions.
No. So what happened was, so my dad's an economist, and my dad's like the example of like, you go to school, you study, you go to good undergrad, you know, he went to London School of Economics, then he went to Harvard, then he worked at the World Bank, you know, which a lot of people and Wikipedia all think is like an actual bank. So they think my dad's a banker, but he's an economist. Very different thing. And the World Bank is not a bank. Try to get an account there. Unless you're a country, then you can. But so that was sort of the groundwork that was laid, and it was successfully done in a way that reinforced, well, that's what you got to do. I got terrible grades in school because I didn't care. If I didn't care about something, I found it very hard to pay attention to it. And growing up in Bethesda, Maryland, which, you know, my parents bought a place they basically couldn't afford, because, well, if anyone lives in America will know this, but outside, like, where you live determines what school system you're in. And there was a very good public school system. So my dad bought a house that, like, basically he couldn't afford, and just he's an economist. He's good with money. He's good with stretching a dollar, figured out a way to make it work because education was paramount. So going into a good school system. So as long as I can remember, you know, when I asked like in first grade, why do I have to go to school? Oh, so you could go to the good middle school. So you could go to a good high school. So you could go to college. So you could get a job and buy a house, blah, blah, blah. That was all mapped out. So I believed that. And then when I went to college, it was because that's what you do. And I was pretty certain that if you don't go to college, you end up homeless. And that was like the most terrifying thing in the world. So I was like, yeah, I guess. And the thing that I look at in hindsight is it's really interesting because it's all part of what I would call a scam. We don't need to get into that. But like the fact that like it's basically illegal to not go to school all the way up until the last day of like 12th grade. And then you could just do whatever you want. And it's like it's so jarring. But
well, you're 17. You make great decisions, right?
But no one even tells you that. They make you feel because so much of this is invested in like the school's ability to say like, oh, these many people graduated and went to college for their numbers. So they have their recruiters saying like, oh, you don't know what you want to do. That's fine. You can figure it out. Like, and great, figure it out on our dime while you spend, you know, however many thousands of dollars a year. But because everyone's doing it, you're like, yeah, I guess that's what you do. Like, I don't know. And that was my thing. It's like, I don't know what I want to do. I have no idea what I want to do. I guess I'd want to do music, but like, I don't think I'm good enough to go to Berkeley or anything like that. My parents would have never supported that. Like, they're like, yeah, you want to go to Berkeley? Go get a job and figure it out. You know, I went to school not knowing what I wanted to do and just kind of failing at everything because I was just there. And I realized something like there were people who were studying whatever field, let's say like journalism or English or whatever. And they were working at bars because they didn't get jobs once they were out of school. And I'm like, well, how come? Like, I thought that was sort of the guarantee. That was the whole thing is that you'll get your job. And they're like, no, I guess I should have learned how to network better. And I'm like, well, how am I going to stand a chance? You know, when I'm doing like philosophy or poli sci or whatever, you know, I was like, oh, I guess this looks okay against people where like, that's what they love. They love that as much as I love music. And that's where that started to turn. I was like, well, I'm staying in just making music all the time.
Right.
Maybe I'm better off just going home, like, you know, see if I could live in my parents' basement and get a job and just do music in my free time, which my parents weren't thrilled about. And I think they were worried I was just trying to be lazy, but I was like, no, I'm just extremely unhappy, you know? And working a full-time job and doing music was actually like the happiest I'd been in a really, really long time. Cause it was the first time that I felt like I had purpose. Like I was actually working towards something that mattered.
Did you have a blueprint of how you were gonna, I mean, there's no way that you could have possibly seen like the sort of web of enterprises and stuff that you guys have now, I wouldn't guess.
No.
Did you have a blueprint on how this was going to work out, or you just were going for it?
When I was 14, I was like, you know what? What if I start a drum software company? Like, no, not at all. Like what it was honestly, I was so lost and sort of devoid of purpose that all of a sudden having a full-time job and just doing music in my free time and being like, wait, I'm allowed to do this? Like that to me was amazing. I was like, no one told me that this was an option. So in my mind, I said, if I could just go out on tour in a van, I don't even care if we make money. Like I'll just spend the money that I make from my job. I'll have made it. Like that to me, maybe naively, but at the time I was like, I'm good with that. That's good. I don't mind working. Like I didn't hate my job or anything. I thought it was kind of fun and it afforded me the time to work on music. And I was like, this isn't a bad gig. Like, again, you're like it beats a desk job, right? Like it. And I knew I wouldn't do very well at one of those.
But the reason I asked is because I think you could. I mean, maybe you wouldn't now because you just, you know that you don't have to, but like, knowing you and your brother, like you could do very well at a desk job if you wanted to.
I don't know. I don't think I would do very well in those environments, you know? I think I'd be very poor in those environments. I've always been a bit of a dreamer. So I'm always like, you need to be chasing something. And it doesn't matter if you get it or not, but it's just fun to chase something, you know? It's fun to work towards something. So I think if I worked at a desk job at a company that I really believed in and I could see what I was doing, like actually changing things or affecting things, sure. But yeah, if it was just sort of
selling insurance or some bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. Like what a lot of my friends ended up doing. And I was just like, God, that sounds horrible. And then the way they would deal with it is just partying and stuff, which I wasn't particularly interested in. Like that dynamic just didn't seem very rewarding to me. No judgment, but it was just like, I knew that wouldn't work for me.
Right.
So that's why I think I sort of gravitated more towards like, hey, I don't mind working a job where I can sort of efficiently make enough money to get by. And then just in my free time, I have free time to do music with. I have a little bit of money to play with, to buy the music stuff that I want. And that was the thing that I got to chase.
And so Animals was the first time that you made enough money to like really replace your income. Cause with, you know, you were getting a lot of love from the community and stuff with Bulb and whatnot on the forums, but that wasn't monetizing in any way, was it?
No, not at all. And I had so many people ask me why I didn't, but it's just because I felt really guilty, because what I was putting out there was just like these unfinished, it's like these low responsibility ideas, right?
Right, right.
So the idea of charging for that just felt so counterintuitive.
I mean, the only thing you could have done back then anyway would be Bandcamp, which would have been peanuts anyway.
Right. There wasn't really any sort of vehicle to monetize it efficiently. But people were like, well, why don't you just put it together on an album? But it's like, well, then I'd have to like re-record these and finish them and feel good. And then I'm just back in the same
grind
problem. Like, I don't really want to make an album. I want to make a periphery album and I want to start a band, you know? And it's like, I get what you're saying, but the result of that is just a little bit of money. Whereas the result of working on periphery is a larger goal. Even if it's not money immediately, it's something that's important to me. So that's why I always focused on that. But I did have a lot of people ask why I didn't monetize that stuff. And I kind of didn't do anything with it forever until like kind of recently. And again, it was just because Spotify and 3Dot offered an efficient vehicle to put it all right out, you know?
And at this point, the expectations for that would be super low because everyone understands what it is.
Yes. Yes. You know? Yes.
So
whereas then it's like, I know these are unfinished, unmixed, kind of rough ideas. People shouldn't have to pay for that, you know?
Although I've listened to some of that stuff recently, and obviously it's rough in a lot of ways, but it sounds really cool for that same reason.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, there's a lot of records that I love. For example, I love Chaosphere, and mm-hmm. I think the mix is really cool, even though it's like objectively not great, but I love it and I don't wish it was any different.
Or like the first Born of Osiris album, you know, sounds,
I think that sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds putrid by like textbook standards, but it's awesome for what it is.
That's how it sounds. So I get that. And I also know that I feel like with any of your especially early work, like I feel like the mixes are just horrible on my things. But then, you know, I did the solo album and I redid some of the songs and it's so disheartening. Like people are like, oh, it's not as good as that old version. I'm like, that old version sucks. That was the whole point, you know?
What's crazy is I remember hearing that stuff back in the day and thinking that it sounded insanely good. I was like, how the fuck does some guy, you know, in his bedroom make something that sounds this good? This is insane.
I didn't even think it sounded good back then. It was just the best I could do. Because again, I was like comparing everything I was doing to like Paul Ortiz, like Chim Spanner, and like Ackle and Brown were all doing, and all their stuff sounded way better than mine. So I was like, well, we'll get them next time, you know? Like,
yeah, well, it's just
trying my best.
There's just something to capturing a specific moment in time. Mm-hmm. That there's, you know, it just is what it is. You can't ever, like, any recording is a product of like the actual air that was moving in the room at that time and your hand and everything. And there's just no other way to recapture that.
Yeah, Finn, that's a very romantic way of looking at it. I don't mind that, actually. I like that.
Would I suggest putting out a periphery album that sounds like that today? No.
No.
But it sounds really cool for what it was at the time. And I still think it sounds good in that way.
I definitely see what you're saying. And I think like our generation is also very affected by nostalgia for whatever reason, or maybe that's every generation. We just have the tools to re-explore it more efficiently than other generations. But
well, I really like a lot of the stuff from like the mid to late 2000s that was coming out of MySpace and stuff. For example, like the early Whitechapel stuff. Mm. Like I like a lot of the stuff from that era. in the same way as I like early punk and hardcore stuff, because it's like really raw and has like a kind of energy that when you learn how to do things the right way, you just, you it's a different vibe. It's not necessarily better or worse. It's just different. It has that kind of like, you know, you leave in mistakes. I wouldn't even say mistakes, like imperfections that now you would EQ out. And that's not wrong, but there's something I really like about sort of those earlier kind of digital native recordings that I think is a like actually a genuinely unique vibe. Does that make sense?
What you're saying makes so much sense. And it's something that like I struggle with and have always struggled with a little bit. It can be extended to what I call demo-itis.
Yes.
When you when you're doing an album, because usually when we're writing, at least, there's this honesty and this intent to get the idea out and to just get it good enough and not obsess over the minutiae in this really clinical way, because you're like, well, we're just trying to get the idea out. And what you end up with is a vibe that can sometimes get erased when you do it for real and
exactly.
You really try to get it perfect. And you realize those imperfections are what gave it character and a little bit of vibe. And sometimes you end up chasing that, and sometimes you end up not nailing that. So it's a really interesting thing that you're bringing up, because it's something that like, that's something that I would say, I would wager most musicians who demo stuff and re-record it struggle with. This idea of when you re-record it, you end up with something that's not necessarily better, it's just different.
Right.
That can be kind of interesting and difficult sometimes. And then lately, I've been focusing more on trying to not erase those things and find ways to preserve that and to keep that stuff kind of sacred, because I've been through so many rounds of cleansing all the character by trying to make things sort of perfect. Like we were saying, like textbook perfect.
Yeah.
But then it kind of loses a little bit of what makes you you. And it's what you're talking about. It's like the air was moving, the vibe, whatever it was in the room, yeah. There was some energy, this almost palpable energy, like when you're in this creative mode, which I love. And then when you're redoing it, you're doing it under the lens of like, okay, now I must make this presentable for everyone else. And it's just your mindset's completely different. And it is really, really hard to get into that initial mindset. It's really easy to get into the clinical mindset.
Yeah.
That sort of flow state mindset of like, oh, the ideas are just, this could be anything, you know, which is one of my favorite feelings in the world. That is really, really hard to just make happen in the first place, but it's nearly impossible to recreate. So you'll never really nail that intent.
And you can never make yourself naive again either.
Yes. No, now it's already a formed thing and you're used to it and you're used to how it sounds. I can't tell you, like, anyone who's demoed stuff and re-recorded knows exactly what we're talking yeah. about. And anyone else will be like, that's I don't get it, you know, but it's such a massive part of the dynamic, and it has caused a lot of disappointment with final mixes over the years, to where like I'm actively trying, especially with this latest album we're working on, that was like a big thing of trying to keep that stuff kind of sacred somehow.
Right. One of the really exciting things of that forum era of, you know, call it the mid 2000s to whatever, the mid 2010s or something, is the tools were evolving a lot too. So you could get really excited about, you know, like when the Le Poulin plugins came out, it was like, holy shit, some new like IR pack came out that was fucking amazing. Just all these like, you know, there was a real step change in these tools that, like, to me was a big part of the creative process, is just having this new thing that unlocked a lot of potential that wasn't there before. And, you know, obviously, because of companies like GGD, the tools are better now, objectively better in every way. But it feels like you don't get those kind of like crazy step changes that you used to.
I would agree with you. I think the one thing is that I was coming up with this group of people where this was like possible for the first time ever.
Yeah.
No, you know, you got to understand, like, my first recording computer was a gaming computer, you know?
Right.
And the idea of having a recording computer was not a thing then, you know? And it sort of became a thing. And then the idea of like, I remember I was making those demos, which I considered to be terrible, but people were just amazed that I could even do that, because that's just right. Not something that you could do. So then you have an industry that starts to cater that. They're like, oh wow, there's this whole movement of people just making music at home, and studios are super expensive, and it can just streamline the process, and you can sort of, you know, do the pre-production on your own and save a bunch of money. It's a win-win all around. So then you start to have support for that. And those first few, you know, it was always like professional products or something that was just appropriated for our context. But now right. You have products that were actually aimed at someone like me. And that's where you would get these quantum leaps, because now you have something that's actually the purpose is they want me to buy it, you know, or pirate it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like that, to think that everyone was so excited about Podfarm, which, you know, was great for what it is, but was pretty crappy just literally because it existed.
There was nothing. Yeah. Yeah. It was like, wait, you don't even need the pod. It's just running on your computer, and you can run as many instances as you're. So if you have a really powerful computer, you could just keep running instances. Like, it was insane. And you can change it in real time.
I remember the first time somebody told me about it, I was literally asking, I was like, wait, so it's like software that sounds like an amp? What? Whoa. And there's 20 different amps in there.
And like, you can change, like, oh, I've recorded it, but you don't have to reamp it or anything. You can just change how it sounds after the fact, and you can automate stuff. And I was like, okay. Like, then you just see all these ideas popping, these doors open. You're like, wow, this is going to kind of change everything. And it did, you know, now you got like Neural crushing it.
Right.
And putting out products that, like, you know, if that's on an album, you wouldn't know, you know?
Fuck no. Like, like you can hear even the best Podfarm productions. You can hear Podfarm a mile away. Like the stuff Joey did, you can hear Podfarm on it. And I would say he used Podfarm better than anybody else ever did.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can still hear it. And now it's like, you would be hard pressed with a gun to your head to hear the difference between, you know, a real 5150 and the best amp sims.
Yeah, yeah. Like the only way that you would know to even listen for that is if someone told you, like, well, one of these clips is a amp sim and one's a 5150. Which one is it? You know?
And if it's kind of a coin toss.
But like, but that's not how people listen to music. And that's not how most people consume music, you know?
Right.
Even if they are listening and they're like, wow, the guitar tone's great. Very rarely will they be like, I wonder if that's an amp sim. I wonder which amp sim that is. Is that, you know, like, so it doesn't actually matter. And it's at the point where it won't break the fourth wall anymore. And you can have these tools where you could get these sort of very finished products just using software and things that are readily available for not that much money. So I think it's a good thing, but it's been interesting to watch that. I think we've both seen from before it was even officially a thing and how that's grown to where we are now and like the level of tools that are available.
Is it harder for you to get excited about tones and gear and stuff than it used to be now that you can basically afford whatever you want and you make some of these products? Like, how do you stay excited about that?
I think so actually. I think maybe, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, it's like what you said, where the you're not getting these leaps from like Podfarm to the next thing or AxeFX or I remember the jump from Pod XT to AxeFX was like, oh my God, like, what, how, right? And AxeFX 2 to AxeFX 3 is like, cool, there's some cool routing stuff.
Like, yeah, it sounds 10% better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
2 still sounds pretty good.
I mean, as with all things, you know, as you sort of iterate, you're going to get diminishing returns with everything. And that makes sense. But these returns add up, you know, so these are genuinely better things. But I've also found myself just getting less picky. I remember Nolly telling me one thing where he was like, you can always kind of make it work. And just understanding, maybe look, I'd say my approach and my view of this stuff has really changed. There's a couple things that Nolly said. It's always Nolly said something. Like, he said something else that really stuck with me, because like, let's say you put out a record and there's just something that wasn't quite right, but you know it, but no one else, or there's a little mistake, or there's this or that. And it's like, yeah, it didn't come out the way I want, but whatever. But he was like, you know, the audience always gives you the benefit of the doubt. So when they hear that thing, they think that's exactly what you wanted.
Right,
and in some cases, they actually love that thing. And I found examples of bands that I love that did that, where I would go to them and be like, I love them. They're like, oh, that was actually a mistake. That wasn't supposed to be like that. I'm like, no, I love it. So being on both sides of that, you sort of realize like, there's definitely this sense of the benefit of the doubt. So if your guitar tone is just kind of weird, but it's quirky, people assume that that's exactly what you wanted. And, and that is what they associate with it. And maybe what you wanted, if you ever got another shot, they'd be like, yeah, you know, it's, but it's not as good as the old, it's kind of that whole demo that or the thing you spend the time with. But there's this trust that like that was the way it was supposed to be. So then you realize the pickiness with tones is like you're chasing something, but you very rarely get it. And sometimes you just have to commit. And we are in this age where you have just infinite options. And we've also now gotten to the point where you can change everything.
Yeah.
So you could just use a different plugin or this and that. And that could give you total option paralysis. So now it's actually kind of sexy to go back to amps and just print it and just deal with it, you know, like, because you're starting to realize like not having those options would sometimes just allow you to move forward and just commit.
Yeah. Which is a great problem to have, that, you know, someone with a normal job that doesn't have a ton of money can basically have, you know, all the world-class options that they want on their computer is pretty fucking cool. And so now we have the opposite challenge of like, how do you, you know, construct your creative process to sort of account for the fact that you don't want to go down the rabbit hole of fully exploring every single one of those at every step, or else you'll never actually finish a song.
Right. You'll never make music then.
And it crushes all the life out of it in so many cases. So my question, like specifically with GGD, is like, how do you deal with that sort of diminishing returns part? Because I think when GGD came out, I think that was maybe not like, you know, a Pod Farmed Axe FX level step change, but I do think it was a step change, like, you know, because I was part of that launch. And I remember like it was noticeably better sounding than pretty much anything else.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, I don't think that we're ever going to, or if there's going to be something like that, we're not probably going to be part of that. It'll be something else that we can't predict. But I remember with that first Halperin library, like thinking that was really special. And I'm talking like an end user, because I was like, my God, like this is like a shortcut to what I want. The you know, I loved the tune track stuff and I used it for forever, you know, but it was a real challenge. It was like over processing just to try to get what was in my head. And all of a sudden it was like I was using a third of the plugins and just getting there. And I was like, oh, it's possible. So that was just an exciting experiment for us. It was like a proof of concept. It's like, I wonder if we could pull this off. And then when you get in, you're like, oh, we really pulled this off, at least for ourselves, you know, like just as a product for myself to use. And I remember when we were doing it, I was like, oh, well, worst case, at least, you know, I've got the kit that I'll be programming with forever. And I was really happy for selfish reasons. But, you know, then that obviously kind of had a much bigger scope than we ever expected it to have. But obviously, you know, you have a lot of different styles that you can explore, but it is kind of a classic problem of like, where do you go after a certain point? I will say that like, even though there are diminishing returns, they are worth chasing.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe I'm just that type of sick in the head and I'm friends with all the same people who are sick in the head that way, where that 5% is totally worth dedicating years of your life to.
5% here, 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 and here. And now it's 40% better.
I do think that our newer kits are better and there's a lot of stuff. Again, it's just because I'm also an end user, you know, I'm getting feedback or I'm giving feedback after a while, or like very much like an album, like where you're saying, well, we'll get it next time.
Yeah.
So stuff that didn't quite come out the way that we want, we're like, well, okay, well, but next time we're going to get it. It's great to have that opportunity.
That first Halperin library is such a good example, though, of what you were talking about earlier of sort of, I don't want to say it's not that it's good enough, but that people will give you the benefit of the doubt, because like, I remember there was that one snare sample where you can hear Nolly's voice in it.
Yeah.
But everyone, you know, and you know, maybe you're like, oh my God, how the fuck did we let that happen? Oh, I suck. This is terrible. But everybody's like, oh yeah, it's fine. We just edited it out. Whatever. This sounds amazing.
It is interesting to see that whole dynamic. And I think also, you know, when we put that out, we were just, again, just seen as like some kids just doing a thing, you know, and now it's become, you know, a pretty serious company. So now there's a lot more people working on everything and sort of ensuring like and quality control and all that. And there's still stuff that goes through, but we can always update and whatever. But yeah, I do like how kind of punk rock that was, though. You know, it was very much like, well, I don't think this will cost very much money to do. It'll just kind of cost time and like trust that we could pull it off. Let's just see what happens. That it was just a let's see what happens moment, and maybe we'll make our money back, you know? Maybe we'll make our money back and we'll have a really cool kit to play with, and I'll be really happy because I adored that kit. I still use it to this date. It's part of my Franken kit.
Oh, nice.
The snare on that, the P3 snare on that is on pretty much every demo. It's on the Haunted Shores album. It's on the Bulb solo album. Like, it's kind of cool. Like that is a very special library to me. And I don't use it because I have to. I just think it's got a lot of character. Kind of like what we talked about. It's like, we didn't know any better. Just going for it and seeing what happens, you know?
Right. Well, I will let you go. I know you got the rest of the day ahead of you, so I appreciate your time. Any words of wisdom or anything else you want to leave the people with before I let you go?
Oh, man, I'm bad at this. I don't know. What's good advice? You're smart. You were always the smart one, Finn.
Well, now I'm put on the spot. Good advice is don't put your money in risky crypto assets. That's my
there
advice.
You go. So it turns out, kiddos, that diarrhea coin was not the way to go.
Yeah, who could have seen that? Putting your 401k in Cum Rocket was a bad move.
But we can give good advice in hindsight. So yeah, don't do that. All right, good advice. If you think you're playing the latest Wall Street bets pump and dump, you're already too late.
Yes, you're the bag holder. If you're not sure who the bag holder is, it's you.
Yes, you'll be holding the bag. At least you'll never be the ultimate bag holder, which currently seems to be Elon Musk.
yeah, that's a fun one. All right. Well, I appreciate it. Good to catch up. And hopefully I will get to see you in person soon.
Yeah, man. It'll be good to see you.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, my friends. That does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with.
The way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.